This morning, we're going to pick up where we left off last week, which is that we need to complete the gas chapter. So we've gotten through a fair bit of the chapter already. In fact, if I wanted to just walk through the table of contents a little bit and walk through the chapters, let's see. We did talk a little bit about phases of matter. So section 5.1 here gets into what a solid, a liquid, a gas are, and has a little bit of the same type of discussion that we had in class as far as what would phases of matter look like on the macroscopic level and what would happen at the microscopic level. And then, of course, we settle into gases because that's the point of the chapter. You do need to know that pressure is force over area. And for lab, you're going to need to know that discussion that we had about the column of mercury. So even though I had tried to de-emphasize it a little bit, that whole discussion in section 2 for lecture, for lab, we're going to have to talk about it again. In section 1, you know that already happened, and then section 2, we'll get to it later this afternoon. Section 2 also has the units of pressure, which we've gone over. And then, let's see, that's the end of section 2. So section 3... as I've already said, the individual names of Boyle's Law, Charles' Law, you don't need to know those names, but you do need to understand the relationships there, which that's why we talked about those three types of problems, the balloon, the metal can or metal box, and then the piston, because those get at those three laws. Now, there's one law left that really is directly related to the ideal gas law in spirit, which is Avogadro's law, which says that the pressure of a gas is proportional to how many particles there are. Not which kind of particles, just the total number of particles. So we'll come back to that in just a moment. So then the text then gets on to what STP conditions are. It does use the older conditions of 0 degrees Celsius, 760 Torr. And then it does the manipulations of the ideal gas law like we did, where we looked at making relationship to molar mass and to density. And that's in section 4. Then we get to where we need to finish off today, which is in section 5, which is the kinetic molecular theory. So kinetic molecular theory we already had talked about, because that's where the graph comes from. And I'm going to put that graph up one more time. So remember that this is a population graph. So it's number of molecules on the y-axis and the energy per molecule on the x-axis. And this is that graph that has what do things look like at higher temperature, at medium temperature, and at low temperature. And the point is that the distribution of energies changes. Now, before we were using this graph to talk about vapor pressure and why gases will form automatically from liquids. But now let's come back to another aspect of kinetic molecular theory. So there's an equation I'm going to write down that I'm not going to even attempt to explain where it comes from because it's beyond the scope of the course. I'll write it exactly the way it's in the text so I can explain it a little bit. Okay, what is this equation in English? The average kinetic energy of a sample of gas molecules. Let me switch colors here. So average kinetic energy of a molecule, a particle, let's say, of a gas, is directly proportional to temperature. And that's why the shapes of these graphs change with temperature, or one of the reasons. So again, the average kinetic energy of a particle of gas is directly proportional to its temperature. So the higher the temperature, the more energy that that molecule is going to have. Now, your book then does the following transformation. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to identify my variables here, which, let me just do that down below. So in this case, EK bar, that bar on top, it means mean, which also means average. It is the average kinetic energy. Na, that is the symbol for Avogadro's number. R is the gas constant, T is temperature. Okay, so here's what your book does. It says, all right, if kinetic energy is kinetic energy, there's an equation that we can substitute for that. And so we could say that the average kinetic energy, this EK bar, that is equal to 1/2 mv squared. Why does it use u instead of v? Because v would technically stand for velocity, which is a vector. I presume that's why it's using the letter u instead, to mean speed, which means how fast you're going without worrying about what direction you're going in. So that's why I'm going to use what the book uses and say 1/2 mu squared. But it would be the average of those speeds. But even more confusingly, it's not the average of the speeds themselves, it's the average of the squares of the speed. That's why this bar is above both the U and the 2. So I know this is math. So this is the average of the squares of the speeds. So this is an expression for kinetic energy. We have another expression for kinetic energy up above. So let's take the two expressions and combine them. So we're going to end up with 1/2 m u squared bar is equal to 3/2 r over n a t. Okay, so then we move things around the equation a little bit, because if we take n a and we move it to the other side of the equation, well, then we're going to get 1/2 m n a u squared bar is equal to 3/2 r t. All right. But then this quantity here that's the molar mass. Because m is the mass of a particle, whether that's an atom or a molecule. And then that's each individual mass. That's why the Avogadro's number shows up in the equation at all. But now if we can take an individual molecule's mass and multiply it by Avogadro's number, then that equals the molar mass. So then that becomes, and I'm going to use a different symbol than the book, because the book uses this fancy little m, but in lab I've already been using the phrase mm. So this will be 1/2 mm u squared bar equals 3/2 rt. So then if we solve for u squared bar, oops, not u bar square, u squared bar, that is equal to 3 rt divided by the molar mass. And if we take the square root of that, the square root of the average of the squares of the speeds, that is equal to the square root of 3RT over MM. And this thing is what is known as root mean squared, or RMS, speed. Speed. Which is the speed that... Wait, what's the R in the first equation? Oops, I'm sorry, I'm ignoring my chat window. What does the R stand for in the first... Oh, let me write that out. That is the gas constant. Which the only confusing thing there is that it is... the R does change depending on units. So there are what I call the gas law units and what I call thermodynamic units. And when it matters, I'll talk about it. Right now, I don't want to confuse everybody with that. But there are different values of R depending on your situation. Okay, so I was getting at what this root mean squared speed is. And that is the speed that... a particle with the average energy would travel at. And that helps make a little more physical sense what this mathematical nonsense is. So if you didn't understand the derivation, I'm not going to quiz you over the derivation. It's just my job to slug through it, you could say. But what matters is the result. That if you have an average kinetic energy, which we're saying is related to temperature, then that is related to a certain speed that those average energy molecules would be going. And that is what root mean squared speed is. U, again, stands for speed. And the fussy difference from velocity is philosophy. Velocity has position to it. Take your screenshots because we're furnished with the first page. Any questions, though? Okay, so... it's this last equation that matters most because that takes us to our next topics, which that's really the whole point of this discussion. So let me get now to diffusion and effusion. So they're both very related things, but they're two different situations. And maybe it would make sense if I draw a picture for these. So let's say that we've got a tube where one end you fill up with one gas, let's say nitrogen. And another end we fill it with another gas, let's say oxygen, why not? Of course, eventually... then the nitrogen and the oxygen are all going to mix together. And that process of the molecules slipping past each other, mixing with each other, is diffusion. Right now, that is different from this situation. Let's say that you have a gas that's trying to escape out an opening. Effusion is that process of the gas escaping. And, you know, I said molecules, but that's not accurate because sometimes we don't have molecules. So sorry, but process of gas particles. And so here again, the process of gas particles escaping through an opening. Is effusion. Okay, now both of these things might happen at different speeds, but both of them depend on molar mass, and let's see how we can prove that. So again, copying the book, because it did the work for me, if we have the speed of molecule A divided by the speed of molecule B. For molecule A, we are going to substitute this formula we got on the previous page. It's 3RT divided by molar mass of A. And then same type of expression here, 3RT over molar mass of B. But you notice something, and I want to point this out before I even finish this. Look at the fact that it is 1 over molar mass. If I wanted to use that proportionality symbol, speed is proportional to 1 over the square root of molar mass. So, turning that into English, speed is inversely proportional to molar mass. Remember that as we keep working on this equation here. Because obviously we have 3RT in the top and bottom, right? And we can combine the square roots as well. So we're going to get the square root of 1 over molar mass A divided by 1 over molar mass B. But, you know, let's flip those equations around. And we'll get molar mass B over molar mass A. The B and the A flip places. But that's because speed is inversely proportional to molar mass. So that's exactly what this relationship here is showing. So this is the, again, turning it into English, ratio of molecular or gas particle speeds which is dependent on molar mass. Okay, that really is the, I think, full discussion of this section. Oh, there are two notes that are at the end here, and for chemists, I should at least make a mention of them. There is what is known as the mean free path in this model of kinetic molecular theory, and that means how far does a molecule on average or particle on average travel before it bumps into something else, so the average distance. And it turns out it is for a nitrogen molecule at room temperature and 6.6 times 10 to the negative 8th meters, which means it doesn't travel hardly any distance. Also just states this random fact that the average number of collisions of a N2 molecule on a presumably room temperature and pressure, 10 to the ninth would be billion. So 7 billion a second. Quite a number. But that's the end of section 5. So then the last section that we're going to talk about at all is deviations for real gases. But we're going to do that on Wednesday, because I want to make sure to get to the topic we're really supposed to be doing today. But with the technology and everything, I'm running a little behind my own schedule. So I wanted to cover Section 5 to get that out of the way, but if we could do real gases the next time. Let's see. Oh, someone says, yes, the bigger particle is the slower speed. Yes, that's why the A and the B end up flipping places in that last equation that we did. Okay. If you saw the syllabus for today, you might have been confused because it had sections from previous chapters that you covered in 1A. But that's because the next thing we need to talk about is directly related to something in 1A. And the lab section, we're going to have a brief discussion about that today as well in lab. But I wanted to give some of that discussion here in lecture for everybody. And so what I want to do first is talk a little bit about this. Since we all have our electronic devices, there's no point in asking it, yes, what does this mean? It is valence shell, electron, pair.
There he is, frozen again.
Oh my gosh, again? Repulsion. I guess when I stop writing for a few minutes, it thinks I'm done. Maybe that's what it is. Okay, here we go. Okay, now you can see valence shell, electron, pair, repulsion. What is this theory about? Well, it's about electrons in the valence shell. Why only the electrons in the valence shell? Because they're the highest energy electrons that participate in chemical reactions. All right, what about electron pair? Well, with rare exceptions, in molecules, bonds tend to be occupied by pairs of electrons. Now, there are these things called radicals, which I don't know if everybody learned about them in your classes, because it's not, I don't know if it's necessarily a 1A topic or not. I think it might be. It's a molecule that has an atom that has an unpaired electron, like a single electron hanging out in an orbital. Even if you have that situation, pairs of electrons have more repulsive force, than individual electrons. So that's why it's electron pair repulsion. Electrons normally occupy orbitals in pairs. And a pair of electrons has more repulsive force than a single electron. And then the last part, repulsion. Electrons are like charges. So electrons move away as far as possible from each other to lower the potential energy of the system. Okay, get your screenshots, please.
To lower the energy of what? Because I can read.
Let me try again at that.
Okay.
Of the system. There we go.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. So, we're not going to go through a full discussion of Vesper again, but I want to at least get out the first sets of shapes that you're going to commonly see this quarter. Because, I'll get to that later. Let's get these essential shapes.
Hey, Professor?
Yeah?
Are you actually going to upload these notes if I couldn't finish them?
Yes, and I was behind on the ones from Friday, but I will get these up pretty quickly. In fact, these lecture notes I'll probably get up before the afternoon lab section.
Okay, and also just really quick, what chapter is this on, basically?
So this is, we just looked it up this morning for another reason. I think this is chapter 10 now. Chapter 9 is 10. On... Yes, chapter 9, I believe, is polarity, which we're getting to a little bit here if I don't run out of time. And then chapter 10 is where you get your molecular geometries, which is what we're talking about now. And if you look in the syllabus,
it's going to be through the whole quarter, then, right?
So the reason we're doing these topics, there's two reasons. One of the topics we're supposed to talk about this quarter is intermolecular forces. Why do molecules attract each other? And it's very directly related to their shape. And so that's why we're talking about Vesper theory, to make sure everybody's got a grounding in shape. But the other reason is that because we're not physically in lab, one of the activities that we're going to be doing later in the quarter is to go back over hybridization and bonding, because that's the stuff that every instructor rushed through at the end of the quarter. And that's the stuff that really matters as chem majors or people going into biology-related fields. Like, if you want to know what a protein structure is, well, you got to know how all those atoms connect to each other. So that's why we're reviewing this. Wait. Now, move on here. The class this morning already saw this, so let me explain for everybody else what these notations are I just used here. So this dashed line means that that hydrogen is pointed away from us. And then this wedge, as it's called, it's pointed towards.
Your screen is frozen, Professor.
Oh my gosh, again? Thank you for letting me know. There's so many screens and windows, I easily miss things. All right, there we go. And actually, let's get to the point here, because we know what these three shapes are. In fact, let me give myself the room to do it this way. One moment.
And this is chapter 10.
This is the chapter 10 stuff, yes.
Okay, cool. Effusion and defusion.
No, effusion, defusion, that's the end of chapter 5. That's the gas chapter. We've totally switched contexts now.
Okay.
So, sorry, I just need to give myself some room here for what we're doing next. Which is me identifying these shapes. So, the first three, before I continue on, what are these shape names? Because hopefully everybody remembers these.
Stage four.
Linear, trigonal, planar, and tetrahedral. Correct. Let's see. So linear, trigonal, planar. Let me explain that word trigonal. Trigonal is the fact that it's not a triangle. A triangle would have three sides. This is three spokes, like three things connecting to the center, not a triangle. That's why it's called trigonal. It's called trigonal planar because, in just a moment, we're going to see another trigonal shape. So if you just say trigonal, it's not good enough. So this is tetrahedral. Now, bond angles, which, yeah, you have to look, you can look them up, so it's not evil for me to want to put them in here. I mean, I guess all chemistry instructors by definition are a little bit evil, which, for those who haven't heard it yet, this will work great on the internet.
Is that a sign that you should, that we should keep in mind?
Oh, you know. I'm just saying that every chemistry instructor's got a little evil down in there somewhere. But I use most of my evil for good, so there you go. Here we go. 180 degrees for linear, because obviously the furthest thing that furthest distance that two objects can get in three-dimensional space is 180 degrees from each other. And then we have 120 degrees, because that's what you're going to get when you divide a circle into three parts. And then tetrahedral is... Dr. Evil. no, that would be Dr. Evil. 109.5. All right. I hope that laugh was recorded. Oh, it was.
What do you mean by the witch towards?
Okay, because... thank you. I got distracted looking at the chat window of making the whole point here. Tetrahedral structure is a three-dimensional structure, but if you write four hydrogen on a piece of paper, someone that's never learned this before might think, oh, 90 degrees, because you got four objects on a two-dimensional paper. But this is not a two-dimensional object. This is a three-dimensional object. And so when we write more complex organic molecules, we often use these structures, which, okay, I know this is story time, but let me make a point here. So, if you have a molecule like this, and I'm leaving out the lone pairs just to save time. It turns out that what I just wrote are two different molecules. Because if you built a molecular model of this and tried to put the two molecules on top of each other, you'll find out that two of the atoms are flipped from one structure to the other. So they are mirror image molecules. All right?
Yes.
Okay. So glucose, that's blood sugar, right? Or if you didn't know that, that's what glucose is. It is blood sugar. And it has a left and a right-handed form. The body only will metabolize one form of it. To the point where the brain has a... what's known as the blood-brain barrier, and it has a series of transport mechanisms that prevent the other form of glucose from crossing, making sure only the right form gets across. Continuing that story, enzymes have this property where they only fit and interact with molecules that are the right shape. Furthering that story, there's this famous case, and if you all want to do a little bit of reading up on it, this is thalidomide. It is the example that every organic chemist always uses to shock people into saying, okay, these wedges and dashes matter. Because this medication was something, I believe it was in the 50s, it was originally manufactured. And what it did is it helped cure morning sickness. You know, for women that were pregnant and dealing with the associated conditions, it helped. Problem was, though, yes, as someone already knows, it also caused fetal deformations. In other words, people born with malformed, principally limbs. So the term is horrible. I'm only repeating what was said, but it used to be the term flipper baby is what they used to refer to some of these cases as. Not a very caring term, but it makes the point. And what happened is one form of the molecule did its job. The mirror image caused the deformation. And that is nothing more. I mean, left and right hand, that's all that caused the difference. So that may sound like kind of earth-shattering stuff. That's what you get when you start playing around with molecules and then give them to somebody. So the wedge and the dash actually matter biologically. Right now, it just looks like an extra detail when I'm writing methane. Okay, end of story. Back to the topic. Because we got two more shapes I want to put in here. And here. Clean up my page a little bit. There we go.
So if anything that shows the dashaways and wedge towards, that just states that it could be a tetrahedral.
So the simplest answer to your question is more that the dash means that something is visually pointed away from us and the wedge means towards us. It doesn't always mean tetrahedral. And it doesn't always
mean...
Okay,
so does that mean that it's facing upwards?
No, like sticking out at you. Like, okay. What you're going to have to do to do this better is make a model, which, since you're all not in labs, the best thing you could do is if you happen to have a set of balloons at home, you can tie a set of balloons, like four balloons together to get the geometry there. And then you'll see automatically that two of them, if you hold it in the plane of the paper, you could say... One of those is automatically going to stick out in back. The other one's automatically going to stick out in front, the way that you're looking at it. That's what towards and away mean.
Okay.
Now, getting on with the other shapes. So the last two shapes are trigonal, pyramidal, and bent, which they have bond angles. You know, I always use the fake numbers. Let me look the real numbers up for once. So the bond angle, that's the same one I always use. 107. And then water, I believe, is 104.5, which I'm usually lazy and round that up to 105. Why are the bond angles in ammonia and water not the same as in methane?
Can you say that one again?
Yes. Why are the bond angles in ammonia and water smaller than in methane? And the answer I'm seeing is the electron pairs, which actually they cause more repulsion. Why? Well, because there's no positively charged nucleus on the other side of the lone pair. So the lone pairs have more repulsive force than the bonding pairs. So they squeeze the bonding pairs closer together. Lone pairs have more repulsive force than bonding pairs.
So does that also mean that the oxygen is slightly more negative?
We're going to get there.
Okay.
Good question. You're predicting where I'm going with all this. Are lone pairs considered more negative as well? Oh, snap.
That's slightly negative, right?
Well, okay, I think I know what you're trying to ask. And let me think through before I answer that, because I got to say this in a way that's both correct and makes sense. But let me finish, because I hadn't finished my sentence here. Yeah, lone pairs have more repulsive force than bonding pairs. So the bonding pairs are pushed closer together.
Professor?
Yes. Did it again.
Where are the 107 and the 104.5 angles between? Like, which elements are they between in that moment?
Trigonal, pyramidal, and the bent.
Right. Well, what she's asking is this. That these, like the bond, the hydrogen-nitrogen-hydrogen sequence of bonds, that's where that angle exists. And in water, it is the hydrogen-oxygen-hydrogen sequence.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And because I kind of rambled as I did this, I'm sorry this didn't end up as clean as I usually do it. So to try to put some divisors in here, there we go. What a mess. Okay, but at least you got the basic shapes. Now, one other topic that came up in the past, and I'm not going to write this down today, is the fact that tetrahedral, trigonal, pyramidal, and bent, they're really all part of the same shape family. But we're going to discuss that in the future. I want to get to this polarity question that's come up. And I'm not going to finish the discussion today because we're going to run out of time. But what is electronegativity? Tend to attract more electrons. Yes, I'm going to rephrase that slightly, but right idea. It is the ability or the tendency
from one adder to another.
The tendency of an atom to attract electron density to itself. When part of a bond. And if we could live with a just sort of cartoonish version of the periodic table. If you can recall your electron configurations from last quarter, you might remember that we refer to these as the S, the P, and the D blocks.
The D blocks.
And yes, I did leave poor little hydrogen and helium out here. Which directions along the periodic table does electronegativity increase?
Up and down.
Well, which way?
Up and to the right.
Up and to the right.
It goes from, like, fluorine, the most electronegative, down towards the S.
That's right. So I'm going to write it this way, that we have increasing electronegativity. And yes, fluorine is the most electronegative element. Okay, so what is the word? Oh my gosh, we're so going to run out of time here. Let me show you where we're going to go with this discussion. And a little bit of it comes up in the lab lecture today. That if you have a bond, like between hydrogen and oxygen, and let's say the oxygen is connected to something else, and let's just call that R, because that's a variable name in chemistry. So the oxygen is much more electronegative than the hydrogen is. So the oxygen is going to be slightly negatively charged, and the hydrogen is going to be slightly positively charged. And that's what we're going to call a dipole. The whole point of where this discussion is going to lead first is that even if you have polar bonds, that doesn't mean the molecule is going to be polar. And so we need to that's a little bit of, again, Chem 1A review. But then what effect does that polarity have on how the molecule behaves? That's something a little new. And so that's what we're going to be covering this quarter. So to just wrap up what we did today, in case anybody got here late, we didn't quite finish Chapter 5 on gases, but we made a more headway through it. We only have one section left to cover, which we'll do on Wednesday. We have gone back to Chapters 9 and 10 for a brief review to help us out with what we're going to be learning this quarter. The quiz, because I just got the lecture notes posted this morning, I'm going to release the quiz on Wednesday instead, but it will not have any additional material on it. And then the quiz will be posted by Canvas. So those of you on the wait list, I don't know if I'm going to email you a version yet, because I can't really grade it unless you're part of the class. But I may send it out just so that you can have it for reference. But the quizzes will be posted and then must be submitted through Canvas. Any last questions before we wrap up for lecture today? Could you all raise your hands? Who wants to speak, just so we can take turns? Thank you.
Go ahead.
Allison, go ahead.
Is that the end of the sentence on the last slide there? It says one part of a bond.
Period.
And then it just stops.
Yes.
Oh, it's a period.
Yes, because that is the definition.
Okay, thank you.
Who's next?
And then for, are these the molecular shapes, or is it the...
electron pair shapes, is that what you...
Electron geometry.
So that's the part of the discussion we'll come back to another day, because I mentioned that all of this is, besides helping out for this quarter, we're also going to be doing a review of hybridization, and that electron pair geometry comes up in our hybridization discussion.
Okay, what class do you think that you guys will be going over that for? What day do you think?
It's in the lab schedule. I will tell you momentarily.
Perfect.
May 11th. So if you wanted to...
11th.
Yeah, so everybody, if you wanted to do a little bit of advanced reading just to get ready for that, we will be doing hybridization on May 11th as our lab topic.
Okay.
Anyone else have any other questions? Oh, yes.
Wait. Go ahead.
Do you mind going back to the first page?
Sure. Go ahead. And then your question. I think,
for
Jason, you're up.
Hybridization, what day was that? 4/20? Or
May 11th. This is today's lecture you're looking at, this page.
So that would just be all about hybridization, right?
Yep.
Okay. And then for the one that you started lecturing about today, can you just give a brief description of what was the topic so I could actually look it up later?
So everything in the first part of the lecture here is directly in Section 5 of Chapter 5. So it's about diffusion and effusion. Vesper theory is in Chapter 10, spread over several sections. And then electronegativity, I think, is Section 9.5.
Okay, perfect.
Yes, everybody that needs to leave, you are more than welcome to. I'm going to go straight into office hours after this, but I'm hanging around for people that have questions related to the class first. But anybody that needs to leave, please go ahead too.
Professor, is it a 10 quiz or you get 24 hours?
Right? It'll be 24 hours like I originally promised. So I'll release it right at the end of lecture on Wednesday. So right at 12:30, you could say I'll release it. and it'll be 12:30 the next day.
Okay, thank you.
Professor, where can I find your office hours?
They're in the syllabus. I can just tell you right now, for everybody's sake, it's today at 12:30, right after this. Tuesdays at 1:30, Wednesdays at 5, Thursdays 11:30, and Fridays at 10:30. I made them all different. What's that?
Is it possible I could get the link to the Zoom office hours?
Same as this.
Also the same thing?
I have not changed the... let's see. Jale, I see your question. I'll get you next. It is the same link for now because I haven't implemented passwords or alternate IDs yet. But I will be because obviously there are security concerns with Zoom bombing. Now let me get some of these chat questions real quick. And then Jale, I'll get to you real quick. Do noble gases have electronegativity? They must when they form compounds, but I don't know what those electronegativities are. I'll need to go back to a table and double check. How long do office hours last? All academic hours are 50 minutes long, but I'll probably still stay logged in. And if you haven't seen it, and I know not many people have necessarily used it yet, but I do have a Skype ID that I've created and an iChat ID, and Facebook Messenger just made a new desktop app because everybody's using social media to try to communicate. So I've got those open and running on my work laptop besides email, and I'm going to be catching up on email anytime today that I'm not doing something else.
Okay. Also, just one really
Wait, one second, because I'm still catching up on some of these. Would you be reviewing hybridization before the top? Everybody got probably a really minimal or rushed presentation of hybridization, even for me. So we're going to ease everybody back into the topic. Now, Jale, you've been raising your hand there, so please go ahead and ask your question.
Professor, I mean, for the quiz, I mean, the format, it must be PDF and submit to the Emerson.
Yes, that's why we did the survey. And so what you can do, like, you don't have to print out the original if you don't have to have a printer. You need to, did you sneak in here? You don't have to print something out. You can just look at the questions on your screen, write the answers out, take pictures. I'm not trying to push any one product, but I used Adobe Scan because it saved my butt. Because when you take a picture, it then straightens it out to rectangular again. You know, you might be taking things at an angle depending on your lighting conditions, and it helps straighten that out. So, and you can put everything into one PDF and then send it to me. That's why we did the survey practice, so everybody had some practice doing that before we had to do it for real.
Okay, got it. So it just writes the answer and scan the PDF, right?
Yeah, you can do anything you need to do as long as eventually it ends up as a PDF.
Okay, got it. Thank you, sir.
So like some people are really technologically trained. So some people take the PDF I send, they split it up, and then they answer it in their own PDF document. You can even do something like this. If you wanted to just open up a word processing document and type your answers in, and then you could, on a Mac, anything that you print has the option to save as a PDF. Like you just hit Control P and look down on the bottom left of your window, and it'll have this button there that if you click on it, you can save anything as a PDF. Because actually, if I understand correctly, if it hasn't changed, everything displayed on a screen on an iOS or Mac device are all just PDF formats. So that's why PDF's so easy on the Mac. PC, there's things you can do too. I don't use a PC, so I don't yet know if it's built into the more modern versions of Windows. But I think PDF for free is a tool for the PCs to use to be able to print Word documents at least and translate them into PDFs. And any of you that might use a free PDF tool for the PCs, if you didn't mind either throwing the suggestions to the chat window or emailing me for people, I'm sure there's going to be people that need some help. So I don't mind some suggestions for anybody that's technologically savvy in that sense. Mm-hmm. Okay. More questions.
Yeah, I have one question. For that last question on the bottom where you put H, O, and R.
Yes, the R is...
Where the A is slightly negative and the H is partially positive. What is the R? Is that just like a...
it's a variable name.
Just a variable.
So I'll write that into
whatever is more electronegative than the O, then that would... technically be the slightly negative part.
Right? Yes. And so if you had fluorine connected to oxygen, that's the one case where that happens.
Fluorine and oxygen?
Because fluorine is more electronegative than oxygen.
Ah, yes. Okay. Makes sense.